Welcome back, murder friends, to
Under the Influence of True Crime. That's Kate, and she's telling our story.
And that's Em, and they are under the influence
of adrenaline.
Pure energy.
Just straight violence,
why
honestly.
Why are you asking? I will insert that clip here.
All right, my mom should be there any second.
Okay. What the fuck?
Surprise, I just surprised my bitch.
I absolutely sobbed.
I know, they were clutching onto me so tightly, and I was like, are you crying right now? And you're like, yes.
I sure am.
I was like, oh, okay, great.
I was absolutely sobbing.
I left full shaking, so it was very emotional for us.
It really was. I had no idea she was coming.
No, that's what a surprise is.
But, like, sometimes when people try to surprise me, I, like, have a feeling that I'm, like, you know?
Yeah, but I know how your brain works, so I know how to work around it.
Yeah, truly. Anyway.
How awesome did I do?
So good.
Did you have any suspicion
literally
that it was gonna be me?
None at all. You were like, my mom's walking in right now, and I was like, oh, hey, Lord, what?
Yeah, because I know what to do.
So now I have my bestie with me and our best friend, dinner.
We're recording together.
I'm so excited. And we're recording together.
All right. You want to talk about some crime?
Oh, I want to talk about some crime news.
Oh, hit me.
Because we weren't going to update on the Gabby Petito case unless there was something to update on.
Oh, there is something to update
on. And there is something to update on. They released the autopsy results, and not only had she been murdered 3 to 4 weeks before her body was found, it was also from strangulation, which we knew that was going to be what happened, because, like, 9 times out of 10, if it's person that, like, if it's someone that they know, it's strangulation. So we had, like, assumed that. We had some suspicions about it, but that is what happened. That's the only update that we have, though. There's nothing else.
I keep seeing those, like, haunting tweets where they're like, wow, so her last, like, moments were looking into the eyes of someone she thought loved her, and I was like, oh, don't do that to me.
Don't do that right now. No.
So.
And then the only other update is it is definitely starting to look more and more like the Zodiac killer that they identified is not probably it. Yeah. There's definitely been, like, some, like, suspicion surrounding that also, but yeah, it's starting to look like that's more of a theory than anything.
More of a theory than a concrete decision.
Truly. So
we love that.
We'll see. If they do DNA tests on that, though, I think that's all the business that we have, though. Other than I'm still crying.
Yeah, I was like, are you ready to record?
It was immediately. Like, she got here 5 minutes ago. I was like, wait, great, let's record. And I'm like, okay.
It's actually been over 30 minutes.
Wow. Okay, yeah, let's go. All right, well, let's just get started then.
I'm going to hit you guys off with my trigger warning. I should probably tell you what we're doing.
Oh, also, yeah, because it's still Spooktober.
Yeah.
This is our second to last Spooktober, is that right?
It's our third Spooktober. Yep,
third Spooktober.
Yep, that's correct.
Well, I just mean we have one left.
Correct. The Spooktober finale.
The Spooktober finale.
The pinnacle of spookiness.
We're ready. Okay.
So I'm doing the case of Martha Moxley. And the reason I picked this one was because it happened the day before Halloween. And Em is going to cover a Halloween murder. So it felt like fitting in the chronological Spooktober order.
Truly, yeah.
So here we are. So we're going to talk about Martha Moxley, who was murdered on October 30th, 1975. And first, I'm going to hit y'all with my trigger warning.
Trigger warning?
Yes. I'd like to warn you all that this is gruesome. There's some murder. Yeah, I know. In case you guys didn't know.
Shocker.
Stabbing, some bludgeoning, animal death,
oh,
and sad times.
You're going to warn us before the animal death happens, though.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, I am. So Martha Elizabeth Moxley was born August 16th, 1960 in San Francisco, California to parents Dorothy and John David Moxley. She was the second child in the Moxley family after older brother John, who was 2 years older than her. And Martha and her family's life before their move to Connecticut in 1974 is mainly just like speculation slash like undocumented. And so like her brother John does talk about her. He talks about how Martha was really easy to get along with because she was so upbeat and friendly. He said, quote, Martha was a person who had everything in the world going for her. She was friendly, she was athletic, she was talented in the arts. Everything seemed to come very easily to Martha. Some of her friends from Piedmont expressed what a wonderful person Martha was, saying she never met anyone she couldn't be friends with. She was a beautiful girl at 5'5 with long blonde hair, and she had just gotten her braces off, so she was kind of like feeling herself, you know what I mean? Like, so, you know, Martha was kind of feeling herself. She was new to the area, and she was about to vibe hella.
Vibin'. Yeah. Straight vibin', as they say.
Hell yeah. There seems to be some kind of incorrect belief that Martha grew up in the Belhaven community in Connecticut. Like, and I say that because when I was first reading it, I was like, oh, okay, so they all, like, grew up together? Like, how did this happen? No. She had only moved to the area 18 months before she was murdered.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. She was from a really affluent area in Piedmont, which is in the Bay Area of California, and they moved to an equally affluent area in Belhaven, Greenwich, Connecticut. Martha did really well when she moved to Greenwich as the new girl, and only 9 months after she got into town, she was voted the most popular girl at her junior high.
All right.
I feel like that's hard. As anybody who's ever been new at school, they know that that's not fucking easy. So the two, like, most prominent families in this story are going to be the Moxleys and the Scackles.
I assumed that was going to be the second name, yeah.
Correct. So the Scackles were so...
the like Romeo and Juliet situation?
Not quite. They were so prominent in the area, like, they held so much influence in that gated community, that when they moved in, they nominated her family to join the club, and when they first moved in, they were even told, like, that's where the Scackles lived. Like, it was, like, a big deal to people.
Interesting.
And this is where I would also like to mention that technically the Scackles are related to the Kennedys through marriage. That's a big difference, okay?
It is. Scackles, it's not the same.
Sons are the main focus of this, and they had an aunt who married Robert F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy. This fucked me up, okay? She married Bobby Kennedy after she met him because he was dating her older sister.
Ew.
Patricia. That was why she met him.
Like, ew.
This is my boyfriend, Bobby. Okay, Sister Patricia, that's weird.
Sister Patricia?
You can't do that. You can't that's do that yucky. To your sister, though.
That's icky.
Like, even if your sister was like, no, it's okay, like, you can date. No, you can't.
No, it's icky.
They met on a ski trip. That, like, a family ski trip that Patricia was bringing Bobby on. If you're serious enough that you're bringing your boyfriend on a ski trip, your sister cannot date him after.
That's so gross to think about.
So the sister that married the Kennedys, her name was Ethel. And it seemed like Ethel really stuck with the Kennedys.
What year did you say we're in?
1975.
Okay. Okay. I guess. You just really hit me with a lot of names.
With Ethel,
Patricia and Ethel, yeah. And I'm like, oh, where are we?
Yeah, so it seems like she really stuck with the Kennedy side of the family, and it gave the Scackles some delusions of grandeur, thinking they were Kennedys as well. Like, they genuinely were like, we are Kennedys. And I was like,
no.
You're not by any stretch of the imagination. But, like, that's the thing. The only reason that they are kind of, like, related is in the sense that, like, the son of Robert F. Kennedy was like, ah, yes, that's my cousin, Michael Scackle. Like, that was what made him a quote-unquote Kennedy. And I was
right.
Like,
That's not
whatever.
It's not it.
Question that changed the lives of the Moxleys and Scackles forever was a night the children of Belhaven had dubbed Mischief Night. It was October 30th.
Ooh, spooky-ooky.
Yeah, I know Mischief Night is, like, a thing everywhere, but, like, this is specific to this one. So, basically, they would all get together to fuck around and destroy property because that's what rich kids do when they're unsupervised. So Martha joined in on Mischief Night with her friends, and she was apparently flirting and kissing on Thomas Scackle.
What the fuck, Thomas?
Yeah, the order of these events are kind of skewed, so please just buckle up and bear with me. The kids were planning on ringing doorbells, running away, toilet papering yards and houses, and smashing some fucking pumpkins, which they did. They did do that shit.
That all sounds so much fun.
I know. It was normal kid stuff, not that Em and I ever did anything like that because we were really lame as kids. My mom would take us to, like, trunk or treat, though, and Em's mom would let us eat all of the candy that my mom wouldn't let us sit down with. It was ideal.
Truly.
So there are some discrepancies on whether or not Thomas was actually out on Mischief Night with them, or if he, like, kind of picked up and, like, hung out with them towards the end. But with enough people saying that it seemed like he'd been flirting and kissing on Martha, like, it seems like maybe he was there for at least part of it. Which ended very early, by the way. So apparently their Mischief Night was really fucking early, though. Because,
Mischief Evening.
Dude, literally, Martha was on her way home for her 9:30 curfew.
Oh, so it was mischief late afternoon.
Literally, I'm like, what? So she was leaving the Scackles home around 9:30, 9:45, somewhere in there. Thomas said he saw her walking home at 9:30. It's 150 yards. She should have made it fine.
Yeah.
So the last time Martha was seen was by her friends, though, was, quote, leaving together behind the fence near the Scackle pool in their backyard with Thomas. Apparently brothers Michael and Thomas had been, like, competing for Martha's affections, and it seems like the 17-year-old
guys,
was beating the 15-year-old out for this one.
Let's stop dating your sibling significant other and, like, pining after the same person with your sibling, because
maybe it's weird.
What?
So this is the part where everything gets kind of muddled, but later Michael's defense would say that they thought Thomas was who they should have looked into because he was prone to fits of violent rage, and that someone had said that they saw Thomas and Martha under the very tree she would be found bludgeoned under later.
How many times do you have to like lose your cool for someone to be like, yeah, he's known to have fits of rage?
Violent fits of rage. Like
Yeah.
when somebody is like doesn't hesitate at all to throw the word violent in front of your shit.
Right? It's
Fuck.
aggressive. That's aggressive.
Personally, I think it was Tommy, but I will circle back to that why in a bit.
Okay.
Thomas and Martha did not spend a lot of time together, apparently, though, because like I said, she left to go back to her place around 9:30, 9:45, which is 150 yards away. I looked that up for you guys. That is a football field and a half.
You think I needed the visual?
I did.
Yeah.
I
True.
had no idea
No,
what
yeah.
150 yards was. So it's a football field and a half. On a short walk back to her home, Martha was bludgeoned with a 6-iron golf club so violently it snapped in half and was then used to stab her in the neck.
Oof. Okay.
So apparently she was first attacked in her driveway, okay? And then potentially knocked unconscious and then dragged to her backyard and left under the tree she would be discovered under the next morning.
And it's like before 9:30. Like it's
Literally.
early.
I get that it's October though, so it's probably dark, but there should not be this much lack of supervision at 9:30. So, like I said, Martha was supposed to be home by her 9:30 curfew, and when she didn't come home, Dorothy began calling the neighbors, one of them being the Skackles. But by 3:30 a.m., she still hadn't heard from anybody, so she called the police because Martha's father was away on a business trip at the time. So she was like, I don't know what to do. I gotta do something.
Right.
So Martha's friend Sheila was also contacted by her mom because she was like, hey, have you seen her? Like, what's up? And she was like, no, but I'm gonna come help you look. So she's looking. Martha's friend Sheila, who was 15, would be the one to find her body on October 31st,
Oh,
1975.
jeez.
Yes. It happened around noon. Martha was in her backyard.
Is this the next day?
Yeah, so
Okay.
she died at 9:30 p.m. and around noon the next day is when
Gotcha.
Sheila was gonna find her.
Okay.
So officers that responded to this scene said Martha was struck first on the left temple in the Moxley driveway and was, it looked like, knocked unconscious. She was then dragged face down to underneath the willow tree where she was struck at least a dozen times in the head and stabbed 5 times with a jagged, broken piece of the club, and they left one in her neck.
Oh my God. That's aggressive.
Violent? Yeah.
Yep.
Martha was under the low-hanging branches just 100 feet from her house, and she still had her blue ski parka on, but her pants and her underwear were down at her ankles.
Oh, good signs. Yep.
There's no evidence of sexual assault, but they think that her attacker may have initially planned for one and then got spooked when like a car came by or something.
Right. Or just chickened out.
Literally.
Because they
Also,
seem like a
though,
piece of shit.
one of Michael's alibis later would be that he was jerking off in that same tree. And part of me thinks, like,
Oh,
anyway.
ew, ew, ew. Why are you doing that in a tree?
Because he was trying to look into Martha's window, he said. We're gonna come back to this. Don't worry. That's because he doesn't say this in the first round of alibis. This is in the second round of alibis in 1991.
Also, that's not a good alibi. Oh, yeah,
I
I
didn't
was
kill her. I was jerking in her tree.
in the tree that her body was found near.
Under. Like,
Yeah.
how did you not see it when you were climbing the tree? So,
Yeah.
anyway, so Jeffrey Burns was one of the Mischief Night participants who was the one who said he saw Thomas Skackle with Martha just before 9:30. He saw her tumble while frolicking with Skackle.
Frolicking?
1975. Yes. The 6-iron that was used to kill Martha came from a set owned by Ann Skackle, Thomas and Michael's mother, who had died of cancer a couple years earlier. The handle had
Oh.
her name on it, and it snapped off. The club head was near Martha's head, but the upper part, which was the handle, I think, was not recovered. But, it was the missing 6-iron from the set. They know that.
Right.
So, don't use your dead mom's clubs to murder someone.
Yeah. Good Lord, okay.
Police began conducting interviews, doling out lie detector tests like candy, despite how unreliable they are.
I'm just gonna say it every single time. Polygraph tests are not reliable. They are falsified so easily.
The minute I see that a police department has issued a polygraph test, I'm like, oh, so they don't know how to do police work?
Right, it's like, oh,
Great.
they're just gonna
They just don't know what's going on. Cool.
truly, and they're just gonna admit that. And I hate when people are like, well, he refused a polygraph test.
I'm like, good.
Yeah, no, I also would. If I was under suspicion of anything, I would never take a polygraph test. Don't ever take the polygraph test.
One really great example for why not to take the polygraph test is actually in this case, though, because one of the guys who ends up failing the polygraph, his story is corroborated in the second round of alibis, like I said. So in the first one, Thomas tried to be like, no, I was watching The French Connection with the live-in tutor at my house. And the tutor was like, no, the fuck you weren't. So in this one, this guy was like, no, I was home watching The French Connection. And so Thomas is like, I was with him watching that. And the tutor was like, no, the fuck he wasn't. And so at the end, the tutor, Michael, and Thomas become the three main suspects. And years later, in the second round of alibis, Thomas admits that he didn't join The French Connection until 10:30, which corroborated the tutor's story. And the tutor's life was, like, fucking ruined.
Right, like, why are you dragging the tutor into this? Because they did nothing wrong.
Can you guess what the tutor's first day at his job was?
That day?
October 30th, 1975. Mm-hmm. His first morning was the night Martha was murdered.
Yep, one neighbor that was, like, really creepy and pervy, and he was, like, an alcoholic, looked good for a minute to the police. But after his inconclusive lie detector test, they focused more on the live-in tutor at the Scapel House, Kenneth Littleton, like I was just talking about. He said he was home watching The French Connection, and...
What is up with everyone watching The French Connection? Oh, it's the same person.
So he would later fail some lie detector test, but most people think it's because he was nervous, and he was facing a burglary charge in his home state of Massachusetts, something he attributes to, like, this. He said this, like, getting that great job at the Scackle home, and then immediately being, like, accused of murder completely sent his life into a spiral, and he, like, was fired from teaching jobs. He got into drugs.
Like, I can kind of understand, like, maybe pointing the finger at them, but, like, that's such a brutal attack for someone that you didn't know.
That's the thing. Like, he didn't have any interactions with Martha. He didn't even know who she was. He said the first time he heard her name was the next morning when they were talking about it.
Right.
He was facing those burglary charges in Massachusetts, which he would end up spending 5 years on probation for. And this is the trigger warning for the animal thing.
Okay.
So there's an incident that Littleton just calls the chipmunk incident. And he says the minute he saw the chipmunk, he knew that Michael had done it. So then he finds Michael. And so apparently, and this is fucked up, guys, the chipmunk had been bludgeoned with a golf club, which was just like Martha. And then it was staked to the ground with golf tees. So when he went and confronted Michael about it, he said, Michael, did you do that? Apparently Michael's answer was, who else would have done it?
Ew.
Which I didn't like. And apparently that was only a month after Martha's death. So that's weird. I didn't like that. I don't know how true that is. I only saw it in one spot, and I feel like more people would have talked about it. But I'm mentioning it because it is an account from Kenneth Littleton about his time at the Scackle home.
Right. And he seems reliable.
Yeah, to that. So the Scackle's father was, like, at first slightly cooperative or whatever, but he then all of a sudden, at the suggestion of lawyers, Rushton Scackle blocked all access to his children for interviews, to their school records, and to their health records, like their mental health records. So apparently Tom underwent extensive evaluations to, like, prove he didn't do it, but, like, where are they? Can we see them?
Nope.
I'd like to.
You sure can't.
Yep. So Thomas's alibi was that he had seen Martha leave to walk back to her house, and that he went inside and watched part of The French Connection with his new tutor before leaving to go to his room to work on a paper about Abe Lincoln. At 17, you had a paper about Abe Lincoln at 17?
Yeah, that's like fifth grade shit.
Right? Okay. Kenneth Littleton told police that Tommy did not join him to watch The French Connection until closer to 10:30.
Do we know what The French Connection is?
It's a movie.
Oh, it's The French Connection, not... Oh, we sat down to watch the news.
No, it's called The French Connection, and apparently there's, like, this iconic chase scene from it
that interesting
people, like, now I don't know what it's about.
Okay,
so he joined him to watch The French Connection until closer to 10:30, not 9:30. Michael Scackle came home within half an hour of that is what he had said.
From 9:30 or 10:30? Okay.
Kenneth was like, no, he joined me at 10:30, and Michael was home within a half hour of that. And so he's like, okay,
I gotcha. Okay,
so Michael's alibi was that he was at a cousin's house watching Monty Python during the time the murder was committed, but the cousin...
I thought he was jacking off in a tree.
That's the second round of alibis. We're still in round one.
Gotcha. Sorry.
So the cousin never confirmed this, and Michael would change his alibi over the years. In a little bit of defense for him, though, no one made any effort to talk to the cousin about the night, which is one of the reasons his conviction would be, like, commuted later, because they say his trial wasn't fair. He wasn't adequately represented because they didn't make any effort to contact that person. Also, just as a side note, four different people in this case would try to use The French Connection as an alibi for what they were doing. And I understand TV worked differently back then, but, like, what the
fuck, four different people were watching The French Connection.
Right. And if it's like...
It's because they were like, there were like three different channels back then. Like, what the fuck? And I was like, all right.
Yeah.
But is that movie fucking banging or something? Like, what's up? Anyway. Police now believe that the most plausible suspects were Kenneth Littleton and Michael and Tommy Skakel, either individually or like all together. They weren't ruling anything out. But they had no concrete evidence except for the golf club. And by 1976, the case was considered cold and the Moxleys ended up moving away from Belhaven.
We might want to watch The French Connection.
What is it?
It is about a New York detective and his partner who chased down a French heroin smuggler.
That actually does sound kind
of cool. It came out in 1971. Everyone was fucking with The French Connection.
Hell yeah. So nothing is going to be done about Martha or her case from this point on until 1991. So,
oof.
Yeah. It's so fucking coincidental and scapegoaty, and it's really nuts. So just buckle up for some convoluted bullshit. In 1991, William Kennedy Smith, yes, those Kennedys, was tried and acquitted for rape. During that case, a rumor surfaced that William had been with the Skakels the night of Martha Moxley's murder. This was not true at all, but the rumor was enough to open Martha's case again.
Well, that's good. So, yeah.
This is good. To stop the gossip of this, like, of his family, Rushton Skakel hired a private investigator.
What was the first name?
Rushton.
Okay.
It's the rich dad. White people have no bounds.
Truly.
To stop the gossip of his family, Rushton hired a private investigating firm, Sutton Associates, to look into Martha's death. This was not a good idea for him.
Oof.
It became known as the Sutton Report, which would find its way into, like, tons of journalists. One of them even being the detective who investigated the OJ case, Mark Furman.
C.C. Tinsley.
No. Mark Furman. So both Tommy and Michael changed their alibis, and this Sutton report proved that. They admitted that they lied to the police about their whereabouts the night Martha was murdered, and this was sus to fucking everybody, obviously. Tommy said yes, he did go home around 9:30, and he did see Martha heading home, too. But he didn't go inside and watch TV and work on schoolwork. He turned right around and spent another 20 minutes getting a little friendly with Martha. He claimed they engaged in a sexual act, and then he went home around 10 or 10:30, which lined up with Kenneth's original account.
Right.
So this means that Thomas did have an encounter with Martha that night, potentially in the spot where she was murdered. Michael wasn't actually hanging out at a cousin's house. His whereabouts are largely unknown, but he goes as far as to place himself at the scene of the crime by saying he was drunkenly stumbling around the neighborhood and he climbed up a tree outside Martha's bedroom and started masturbating in the tree. He said he climbed out of the tree because he heard voices, so he ran home as fast as he could, and this was well after midnight.
So he was like, so he wasn't even watching her in her room.
No, because she was
looking
at
her
tree.
Yeah.
Correct.
So, like, no, you were getting off to her dead body below you.
Thank you. Investigators found it really unlikely that he had been up in the tree near Martha's dead body, but never noticed it lying so close by. But he did place himself at the scene of the crime by doing that.
And, like, her pants were down. There was no sexual assault.
Correct.
But he was there jacking off.
Correct.
So
here is my idea, I guess.
I think we're on the same theory.
Part of me thinks that he was drunk. He stumbles.
Because he was, what, 17?
15. Thomas is the 17.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So I think he drunkenly did find Martha. And my thought with this is this. So Martha's excited, okay? Thomas, the 17-year-old, is paying her a lot of attention, all right? She realizes that she's having a good time. And then suddenly, when they're under the tree, you know, she gets caught up, okay? She's 15. Have you ever not been in a situation where you're like, maybe you like got it a little bit too far and then you're like, well, I should stop, okay? So then I'm guessing she told Thomas to stop and he had a violent fit of rage.
As he has been known to do.
So I think that Michael found Martha drunkenly after Tommy attacked her and then he was jerking it over her, which would explain why her pants were down, but also explain why she wasn't like sexually assaulted. And so...
Right, because he wasn't trying, like, was he smart enough to not leave?
I don't know.
You know, like, it's very possible.
Unclear.
He's not into necrophilia, but he is into...
Martha.
Jerking it, yeah, to Martha.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously that's completely speculation. I have no idea what actually happened, but that just, like, from what I've been reading and all this, it just, like, is interesting. It's just kind of like,
Yeah.
So this left the Sutton investigator certain that Michael was the best suspect, and Greenwich police agreed because they were like, that's fucking correct. And I think he was just the more fucked up of the two brothers, so he was easier to deal with.
And And he's actively placing himself at the scene of the crime.
Well, yeah, and, like, so Michael began heavily drinking at 13 when his mom died.
Yeah.
He was arrested for drunk driving in 1978, and then he was sent to the Elon School in Poland, Maine, a private school for kids with behavior issues.
That is, that school is on my list of cases to do.
Well, he stays here.
Fucked up.
Yeah.
That's the school where they were, like, they would literally have a hallway dedicated to children fighting to the death, basically.
So he stayed there. He was there for almost a year, I think.
And this was before the murder?
After. 1978.
And, oh.
She died in 75, and he was arrested for drunk driving in 78. So he's put in there. It's a private school for kids with behavioral and substance abuse problems. Mainly it's for fucking rich parents and rich kids.
It was like an insane amount of money to send your kid there. Yes. And it was just abuse.
Yep. So he ran away a bunch of times from the school before he eventually reached sobriety in the 1980s. Robert F. Kennedy, his cousin, not the original one, also credits Michael for helping him get sober. And he's like a vigilant defender of his cousin being innocent. He wrote a book that was like framed and like, it was so fucking In 1993, Michael married Margot Sheridan, a professional golfer. In 98, they had a son and settled in Florida. So
nothing good happens in Florida.
He's just living his life. In 1998, a one-man grand jury was convened by a district attorney, Jonathan Benedict, to review the evidence in the case against Michael Skakel. This is really unusual to have, like, a one-man jury, but they were just trying to get anything done. It was decided that there was enough evidence to charge Michael with Martha's murder, and Michael surrendered to authorities that same day, but he was quickly released on a $500,000 bail because he's fucking rich. On March 14th, 1999, Michael Skakel was arraigned for murder in juvenile court because he was 15 when murder happened, even though he's a 30-year-old at this point.
Okay.
On January 2001, though, a judge ruled that Skakel would be tried as an adult. And
well,
Michael
said,
"You've got the wrong guy," to her mom. His wife, Margot, left him in 2001, citing the murder shit for her divorce, and his trial officially began in 2002. Lacking forensic evidence, prosecutors relied on witness testimony and a weak changing alibi to make their case. Mm-hmm. The masturbating and a tree thing was talked about like a lot, except for sometimes they would edit out the like jerking off part so it sounded like he was admitting to Martha's murder. It was kind of shady, honestly. They also used passages of his Dead Man Talking book proposal, even though he never admitted to murder in the proposal. He did talk about jerking off on the tree where Martha's body would be later be discovered. Students from the Elon School began coming forward saying Michael had admitted to killing Martha while he was at the school. Greg Coleman testified Michael bragged to him, quote, "I'm going to get away with murder. I'm a Kennedy," saying that he made advances to her and she rejected his advances. He drove her skull in with a golf club. Coleman said that Michael had admitted at least twice to killing Martha at the school. However,
yeah.
Coleman died of a heroin overdose in 2001, and so his testimony is largely, like, unreliable because of that.
Right.
But his widow, Elizabeth, was called to corroborate her late husband's testimony, saying he had told her about Michael, that he had murdered that girl with the golf club, and that he would get away with it because he was related to the Kennedys. So she tried to, like, continue on, but he was discredited because he admitted to being strung out on the stand at some point. I don't really think that's fair because I understand that, like, it's a mind-altering substance, but, like, he still is, like...
Right.
It's the same one. There's, like, a CSI episode where this woman witnesses a murder and they're like, well, she's a drug addict, so we won't take her testimony. And I'm like...
That's not... What? That ain't it.
So two other former students, Charles and Dorothy, testified that they never heard Michael confess, but he was mocked and taunted by therapies in therapy sessions, and they said he never admitted to it, but he never denied it. Still weird.
I don't like that.
One female classmate, Elizabeth Arnold, said he didn't know what happened that night. Quote, "He was very drunk, he was in a blackout, and he didn't know if he had done it or if his brother had done it." And that, to me, made me think Thomas did it, and he convinced Michael he had done it.
Right, because he was so drunk.
Like, he was like, yeah. So, Elizabeth said that Skakel was in a jealous rage about his brother Tommy hooking up with Martha, and she asked, "How could that happen? How could your brother do that to you?" And he said, "Well, they didn't really have sex, but they were fooling around. He stole my girlfriend," end quote.
No.
She wasn't Michael's girlfriend, but, you know, that's...
He's just trying to, like, make it seem her fault.
Yeah, like, it was me.
Like, well, I deserve to be able to kill her because she went and hooked up with my brother.
Yeah, because she killed her only brother.
No.
On June 7th, 2002, Michael Skakel was found guilty of murdering Martha Moxley, and he was sentenced to 20 years to life. He was assigned to the Garner Correctional Institution in Newton. And her mom told reporters, "Today is a day where there is a winner and a loser. I just hate those days. I wanted to find justice for Martha. That's what this is. It's all about Martha. I have empathy for the Skackle family." She's too nice.
She really is.
Michael would continue to file appeals throughout the years, and in 2013, he would be granted a new trial on the basis that his lawyer, Michael Sherman, had represented him poorly and not given him a fair defense. On November 21st of 2013, he would be released from prison on a $1.2 million bond with conditions that he was to be monitored with a GPS, have no contact with the Moxleys, and check in periodically over the phone. Oh, and that he couldn't leave the state of Connecticut unless he was, like, given explicit permission, which he would be granted to move to New York later with his family. On May 4th, 2018, the Supreme Court ordered a new trial. All of his conditions were removed. The court ruled that Sherman had rendered ineffective assistance when he failed to contact the alibi witness whose name was provided, and that's the cousin thing I was talking about.
Right.
There's still been no trial, and in 2020, the prosecution, a man who was 9 years old when Martha was murdered, declared that there was not enough evidence to retry Michael, and that too many witnesses were dead, so it would make the case too hard to solve. And to that man, I say, fuck you.
Truly. Because, like, no, the person who potentially did it is obviously not dead. It doesn't matter. Like, take it to trial. If you don't have enough evidence to convict him, it'll show up in the trial. You can't say there's not enough evidence to try him again.
Yeah.
Because that was the condition on which he was released.
Was, like, for a new trial.
Right.
Correct.
Oh, what the fuck?
So her mom said the Supreme Court's decision, quote, "The state of Connecticut had a very, very, very good case, and we absolutely know who killed Martha. If Michael Skackle came from a poor family, this would have been over.
Yep.
But because he comes from a family of means, they've stretched this out all these years." She stands by saying that she believes he did it, and so does Martha's brother, John, but she says she thinks justice has still been served, so she's okay with him being free, which I'm not. So.
No, she's too nice.
He only spent a decade in prison for Martha's murder, and that was after getting away with it for so long, but the Kennedys stood behind him, so...
Of course they did.
That was why he made it out okay.
And of course
he is
did.
Free now.
How old is he now? He was 15 and 75.
He's fucking old. He's like 60-something.
He's fucking old.
He's 61.
So, definitely capable of murder again.
You know, so... And regardless, that would only make Thomas
63.
Apparently they have not been in the room with each other since, like, that happened, though. Like,
I wonder if they both did it.
I don't know. I think that this is some sus shit and that one of those Skackles is fucking guilty.
One, yeah, no, those are the only two options.
So.
And I think it was Michael.
You do? I think it was Tommy.
You do?
Mm-hmm. I think it was the 17-year-old. I really think he was hooking up with Martha, and she said no, got so caught up in the moment, and she was like, "Thomas, I don't want to do this." And Thomas was like, "Well, fuck you."
Because to me, it's like, it feels like, I mean, I'm not saying he definitely didn't do it, because, like,
it just seems more plausible to you that it was Michael.
Yeah. And, like, how I imagine, it's like, he might have drunkenly stumbled upon Martha and tried to make an advance at her, and she was like, "No, I'm into your brother." And that set him off, because, like, you know, if Tommy was known to have fits of rage, it's not that far off to say that Michael could too.
True. I guess my thought with this was that it seemed to me that Michael had, like, fallen off the deep end. Okay.
Right.
So to me, it seemed like Rushton was like, "Well, I've got two sons, and this one is already a fucking mess, but I can still salvage this one over here." And so that was kind of why I feel like Michael got stuck taking the blame. I just don't think Michael knows.
Right.
But I don't know. I mean, I think the Skackles did it, end of the day. I just don't know which one.
Right. Or both. Or
honestly,
something.
It could have been kind of like an in tandem. Maybe, like, things got out of control with Tommy. Maybe he hit her or something. And then Michael stumbles upon an upset Martha, and then things get out of hand.
Exactly.
I think both of those boys know way too much.
Yeah, because, like, it could have even been, like, Martha declined, like, stopped doing something with Tommy, and then she was upset, and that's when Michael showed up.
I was like, so maybe, like, she's like, "No, Tommy," and maybe he was like, "Well, fuck you then, you know what, you're not worth this anyway."
Right.
And then she's, like, really upset, and Michael comes up and is like, "What's the matter?" And then, you know how, like, dudes always in those movies, those trashy dudes, always make the move when the girl's crying and upset?
Yes!
He seems like the kind of guy who would do that.
He does, especially if he was drunk.
Yeah, well, not even...
And he was entitled to shit.
True. He was a Kennedy.
No, you fucking weren't, first of all.
Your fucking aunt married up, God
damn. That, I feel like that entire family, Tommy and Michael's whole family and the Kennedy whole family, knows what happened that night. I mean, they're... paying to keep it under wraps.
It makes me think of, like, my Bridgerton novels where, like, something... So there's this one where, like, this guy's treated like shit the whole fucking time. And he's like, Dad, why do you treat me like shit? And he's like, because you're a bastard. Your mom cheated on me. Like, that's what happened. And he's like, but I look just like you. Like, how's that possible? And it turns out she fucked his brother. That's what happened.
Oh, shit.
And I'm like, wow, a plot twist.
Interesting. So the moral of the story, guys, don't
bang anyone that your siblings have banged.
Yeah.
That's maybe just the full takeaway, actually.
Yeah.
If you guys have a better takeaway, let us know.
Let us know. The other takeaway would be, like, don't murder people.
That's our takeaway every time, though, so we had to get you a new one.
Yeah, new takeaway, don't fuck your sibling significant other.
Yeah, maybe if your sibling is dating somebody and they break up, we just leave that person alone, hmm?
They don't, and also, don't make your way through a family tree.
If you're, like, dating family members, stop it. Guys, that is actually the full takeaway. Stop dating people. Don't date people. Just don't. Be weird. If you guys have any questions about whether or not a relationship is okay, feel free to send us an email at...
Send us an email.
If you guys need advice on whether or not a family relation is too close to date, you just let us know. You break down the relationship, we'll let you know if it's appropriate.
If at any point you're like, let's email M and Kate and see what they think, the answer is don't do what you're about to do.
It's gone too far if you're finally ready to reach out to us to see if it's too convoluted.
It's too convoluted.
If you've truly reached out, you're in too deep.
You're in too deep, bitch. Get out. Out of there.
Don't marry anyone your sibling has dated.
Why would you want to fuck someone that's someone not only related to you has fucked? I wouldn't fuck anyone that you fucked.
No, quite literally. I wouldn't want to date anyone you've dated. I wouldn't want to kiss anybody you've kissed. I just, like, it gives me weird vibes.
In your defense, they've all kind of sucked up until this point.
That's all we've got.
That's it for our Spooktober. We've got one last Spooktober episode coming at you next week.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got one more Spooktober.
And it's a good one. It's the Halloween one.
It's our Halloween special, baby.
Halloween-y.
And then after that, we've got another special episode coming. Truly. To see pictures from this case, you can follow our Instagram.
At Under the Influence of True Crime.
You can join our Facebook group.
At Under the Influence of True Crime.
You can follow our Twitter that I never post on.
At Under the Influence of True Crime. I will say, though, that Twitter page is single-handedly my favorite Twitter page I've ever been on. It's like, do you know when you have a tweet that comes out and you read it and you go, that was an emotion I didn't know I had?
Yeah.
I reread our tweets sometimes and it'll be like, hungry for a snack, but also want to know what eyeballs feel like in your mouth. Peel some grapes and go to town, big boy. Oh my God.
All of the intrusive thoughts that I don't want to tweet out, I just tweet out from our podcast
page. They are like orgasmic to me.
I agree.
I see it and I'm like, I'm just going to read our tweets really quick because we only have three. So we started off our tweet, sexy people get vaccinated. That was a good one.
Thank you.
Round two. Under the Influence of True Crime, a show one man described as not very compelling and an acquired taste. Thanks for the review, Tom. So good.
Okay.
Vampire teeth are not little straws. A wild new concept. 11 nuggies instead of 10. Is this McDonald's man trying to fuck right now? Oh! Anyway, everyone should go follow our Twitter, though, because
it's unhinged.
I'm hoping they give me the login so I can start.
I'm going to give you the login.
Intrusive ones on there because I just can't. Nothing makes me happier than when it's a random moment and I get a tweet that says, under the influence of Chicago, like, what fever dream did we come out with? I can't wait.
I think the McDonald's one is my favorite one. Is
this McDonald's bitch? I don't know. Twice in 1 week, it was the same McDonald's. He's definitely trying to fuck.
He's trying to fuck. I'm gonna give you the locket, don't we forget. This is the one we've all been waiting for. You can send us an email.
Under the influence of true crime.
@gmail.com. You can also rate, review, and subscribe.
Anywhere you listen to your podcast.
But don't review this one. This one's unhinged.
No, this one has been a mess. But don't you guys miss when we recorded in person? This is a lot less streamlined than the last one.
Right. They're like, hold on. This is the chaotic energy we signed up for. This is the goblin shit that I wanted.
Goblin 4.
You can also catch us right back here next week for some more spooky okie tales.
Peace out.